what a subject that is.
Yes, it is. And I know that there are many people who knew various aspects of Von Braun the man, and I've never really seen it pulled together in a minute. And he had a problem with Major Hamill. You remember
with
Hamill?
Hamill, yes.
Hamill?
James Hamill. Jim Hamill, yes.
Well, Jim Hamill, you know, was a complete sot. You know, he was alcoholic. And
I think I'd heard some hints.
He had moved and had quarters at Fort McNair. He was civilian, but I don't know how he
at that time,
you know, he'd gotten out about the call. He was already out. Maybe he was still in. I don't know. But he always wore civilian clothes.
Now, this was at what period?
When he came to headquarters.
Okay.
Came to Washington.
I never knew that they linked up again.
Hamill had quarters down at Fort McNair, which is six blocks down from NASA headquarters, you know. Hamill was on the phone, all he'd get drunk, and he started calling Von Braun. And Von Braun finally had Curtis, Julie. At first few times, she'd shunt him. So she'd shunt people to me, of course, many times like that.
Sure.
And then Von Braun finally told her, don't, you know, just don't put him through. Some reason to. And Von Braun was great. He said, don't lie. He said, but don't let him know. But he loved that. But anyway, and Hamill would get drunk and he'd come up to headquarters. Come crawling in there. I was out in the... My office was right by the front door, and then Julie Curtis' office, and then Von Braun was behind her.
And he was a civilian with the Army at Fort McNair?
No, I don't think he was in the Army. I don't know what his role. He may have been under treatment for his alcoholism.
But
he had a full-fledged apartment down there.
Okay.
And he would come up, and he would beat on the door. He'd walk in. He wants to see Werner, you know. He was playing, trading on his, you know, long-time association that he had done for Von Braun. But he was just, he had no business with Von Braun.
Right.
And he was just, he was a time killer for Von Braun.
Right.
So Von Braun was doing everything he should to be nice. He said, I don't want to hurt the man's feeling. He did so much for me. He said this to me.
Uh-huh.
And then one day he came in and said, Jim, I want you to go with me. Says, I think if I just go down, he keeps after me to go to lunch with him and do this. And then he says, I think if I just go down to his quarters and have lunch with him or something, said maybe this will, you know, kind of stabilize him and better him a little bit. So we went down and had lunch with Hamill. Of course, Hamill's lunch consisted of liquid lunch.
Right.
But that went on, and they talked a little bit about old times. But Hamill got so drunk, he just started rambling off in all kind of directions, you know, and everything from the future of what we ought to do in the future and what Von Braun ought to do and all these kind of things. But I always thought that was an interesting experience, how Von Braun had to get rid of a pest because he felt an obligation to him and because the man was, you know, he knew what the man had done for him.
Exactly. That's
him.
A difficult
and he
situation.
He agonized over that.
Right.
Okay, another little incident, and this is the one I think probably you might have to tread around, because I don't know that this one could go, but I think you'd like to know it.
Sure.
Von Braun, the father. Several days of Von Braun's conversation with me would be about what's happening to Peter in school and what's going on with the family, you know.
Right.
And they had moved him up, you know, down over there across the, in Virginia, you know. And Falls Church, where do we forget the exact, those lines. Alexander, those lines of those little things.
Sure.
But at any rate, funny thing, the one I was going to tell you about, let me digress to the first one.
All right.
This one was kind of funny. Von Braun would have these laughing stories to me, and I won't tell a lot of, I don't remember all the detail, but one day he came in and he says, Peter's in trouble. he said, they got into the Civil War. This study said, it says Peter said he's a Confederate. It says so he's held forth and for the Confederate cause.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Hell, he's an Alabamian.
But he thing that happened that was most interesting here about the family, several times I'd go get Maria in Von Braun's Mercedes and take her a couple of places. You know, she didn't make a lot of friends there as she didn't in Huntsville. And I'll tell you something about what she said about Huntsville. And I had to spend a lot of time with her. Not a lot of time, but didn't have that much time, but
sure.
But, you know, I'd have to go in the middle of the day.
Right.
And this could have been, I said, today, you know, you could be fired for such a thing.
Right.
We didn't use a government car, just a government employee.
I got you. Right.
And I could have always taken leave or something, you know, so, but at any rate. One day, Von Braun says, came in the morning, said, Jim, I have to ask you a very personal favor. It's very confidential. I said, well, ask away. I'll do whatever I can, you know. And he said, I think I can trust you to do this. He said, I guess it was Margaret. Margaret said, Agnes Scott. I just called Agnes. No, Hank. Yeah, because Iris was in Colorado. At some dude ranch or something. I don't know, mm-hmm. Montana, where she was. He said, Margaret, she's been arrested. Said the dean of women called me last night, Agnes Scott in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
Says she's with a bunch at a pot party. You know, this was back marijuana in the late 60s or early 70s.
Sure.
You know, said so they took them in. The dean of women, I don't remember her name, called me and said she would work with us confidentially to help her. He said, so we're going to have to bring her home. He said, we've got to get her home. He said, the dean of women's trying is keeping everything quiet as she can in Atlanta. So far, the reporters haven't found out about it. He said, we've got to get her up here. He says, we're going to put her on a plane. The dean of women's going to take her out, and, you know, in disguise. And they're going to get her out to the plane. And said, well, somebody's got to meet her over it. We didn't go out to the Dulles. Was over at National.
Sure.
Said, if you take my car and go get Maria and take her out there, and Maria will wear her disguise. In fact, she wants to stay in the car. Said, you go meet Margaret and bring her out to the car. So I did that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but what I'm talking about is Von Braun's sincere and desperate concern for his child.
Mm-hmm.
And he was all the father. He was not condemning.
Mm-hmm.
He was solicitous of her safety and her concerns.
Sure.
Her avoiding any publicity and that
mm-hmm.
sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I get Maria. Maria wore dark glasses and an old hat. And, you know, she looked, you wouldn't know, most people wouldn't have known her anyway.
Right.
You know, of course. But it took her out there, and so she wanted to stay in the car. And she said, no, I'm going to go to the lobby. So she went in, she went over in one of those long rows of seats and sat in the lobby chair, and I went out to the gate of the airplane and met Margaret, who had, you know, herself kind of dark glasses
mm-hmm.
and disguise. Again, nobody would have known her.
Of course.
But it was Von Braun's personal concern, though. That was
yeah.
So anyway, he brought him back and got her with her mama, and we walked out to the car and took him home and came back, and then Von Braun went home. Yeah. Not to be. Not as the chastising father, but as the caring father.
Sure. And that is interesting.
And he came back and told me the next day, he said, that, you know, you'll never know how much we appreciate that. Again, see, his concerns were probably not really too much, because I don't think anybody would have known him one way or the other, even if he'd
right.
No, if he'd walked out there, they'd have known.
Sure.
He couldn't go, you know.
Right.
He knew that. But he said the next day, he said, it's going to be all right. And, that the charge is going to be dismissed in Atlanta. We never knew how that happened. Probably the dean of women, Agnes Scott. They,
right.
they didn't need any publicity.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the charges were dismissed,
yeah.
as far as you know, right?
Yeah, nothing ever happened.
First offense and all of that. Did speaking of Maria, did she make any or many friends up in Virginia? Was she happy, unhappy, neutral about being and living up there?
My impression was sort of neutral,
mm-hmm.
but that she felt a little more comfortable there than she had in Huntsville, because there she basically was unknown. I mean, she was, there was no notoriety, there was no public reputation to uphold.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sort of thing.
Hmm.
What she, let me tell you what she told me about Huntsville.
All right.
And this probably is a summary of three or four conversations. But for one thing, she said, you know, the problem with Huntsville women is, said, that they are, and you've heard this before, she said they're too socially conscious.
Mm-hmm.
She said, I don't have many friends, said I don't, says when I, says they don't have me and Werner over as friends, as people. Says they have us over to show us off, you know.
Uh-huh. Right.
Says, you know, that's your social, that's the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, so I don't socialize. Said I don't like that kind of thing. She says, you know, sometimes I just get in the car and I put on my old clothes and I go driving in the country. Says I've been to the horse. Said I like to go to the horse shows in Shelbyville.
Is that right?
Several times. Said I go in, nobody knows me. Said I enjoy it. Says I like to be by myself. Said I. Said I don't find things in common. With my friends. And the other thing was that came up at another time. And this is, these things are harsh. You have to be careful how you say these. That the wives. In fact, I think I asked the question once. Well, what about the other German wives in town? She said, oh, they're too Hausfrau.
Is that right? What little really that I know of her or have heard about her, that sounds
too Hausfrau. Yeah. The way she put it says most of them are too Hausfrau. I'm sure she didn't condemn
right.
anybody. Most of them are two housewives. You know, and the discussion went on that they have more domestic interests than or their own art interests, you know, things of that sort.
Sure.
They had a lot, and I know that two or three of them, they had their own special interests, their wives, you know. Other than just domestic, most of them that I knew had some.
Mm-hmm.
One or two like to paint, one or two like to do
sure.
music, one or two like to do other things, you know.
Pat Richardson I spoke to just the other day, too. He was Von Braun's... is that right?
I'm talking about education.
Oh, right.
He would always choose the ones that related somehow to students or education. In the many letters that he got that we had to respond to, the ones that came to the top of the list were those from students or professors or people involved in education.
Is that right?
Sir. And he always made the choice. When there were several speeches to be made, a presentation to be made, the ones that had to do with the educational realm.
Is that right?
Educational organizations or institutions or students.
Right.
Yes, and I've heard him say that, too, that
mm-hmm.
it's what's in your head.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you have to carry you.
Mm. A lot of truth to that, I'm sure. Someone, it may have been Foster Haley, it may have been last Thursday, and they either said, ask us later or ask Jim, I'm sure, to tell you about the time when they took Von Braun to the... maybe a striptease
nightclub.
Okay.
In the tour of centers, when we were taking the Gulf Stream and going all over
right.
the country, one of our trips was to JPL and then to Ames. In Pasadena, before we went up to Ames, that's when that weekend he left us. And spent 2 days on the yacht with Hans Mark. You know, Hans Mark at that time was the director of Ames Research Center.
Right.
John Von Braun loved boats. Don't know if you knew that.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, he loved it. He on several occasions he went out on people's yachts or things of that.
Yeah, I don't think I really...
Up east.
Realized
you know,
that,
up,
yeah.
up in New Washington. Well, he spent those days out with... And of course, his other one, he loved flying, you know. And by the way, on this trip, on two or three occasions, as you've heard before, he would fly the tough Gulfstream. And but he would get out of the seat when the bad weather. He didn't try to risk himself. The bad weather stuff cropped up. He said, get out and smell. Well, but back to this occasion. This is one of the great memories I have of him. We were, as we came into Pasadena, we were going to go sometime the next day or whenever it was to JPL, and then we're going out. And we did go out, and I'll tell you about that too, out to Edwards to what it later became Dryden Research, Flight Research Center in the desert.
Right.
To fly the shuttle. And I'll tell you what I'm talking about in a minute. But at any rate, that night, let's see, first night we had, no, that was the next night, the night before we left, with dinner with Pickering on his mountaintop. Okay, well, here's what happened. Anyway, as we got settled, and Von Braun called me, and Frank Williams, and it was somebody else was with us. He said, fellas, I'd like to kind of go out a little bit. Said, they would go out, find a little entertainment and have dinner or something, And so I got on the phone to people I knew, out there. And we stayed and went down, talked to the hotel people. And tell me some place that's not too raunchy, They got this strip, in Pasadena out there.
Right.
And we could go and have dinner. So they told us a place. So we went to some place. We had a good dinner, whatever it was. I don't even remember the name of the place. But then Barbara said, now shall we have some entertainment? Aren't there some places we can go? So I had the names of some. Frank, as I recall, Frank Williams and I didn't even talk about it. But so he wanted to go to a strip. He said, I'd like to go to an entertainment place. He never said strip. So we went to this bar down that did again. And we went into the bar, and there were the naked women dancing on it. It was a dance bar, But there was a lot of dark, like about the side of this room. The bar was over there, and all around it. The drunks were sitting. It was under the naked women dancing.
And we're talking about naked.
Okay. Naked, that's right. And so we went over to the corner. I was gathering, about four of us. And we sat over in the corner, and as we sat down in the dark, Von Braun didn't say, now let's don't make too big an issue of this, We sat down about that time, some loud voice says, hey, Werner Von Braun! From over across the way. It was John Noggle, the space and science application, and his crowd. It was they had out there for something at JPL.
Right. What was his last name?
John, N-A-U-G-L-E.
Okay.
He was actually kind of an older fellow, but he was all right. He was kind of a straight-laced fellow. Spare surprise.
Right.
But
he was from where? From headquarters or
space?
Okay.
He was the
directorate
of the directorate of space application. He was the George Miller of space and application.
Okay.
The head of it, and very respected. And one of the people that Von Braun had a great deal in common with, and spent a lot of time with in headquarters, because as I told you, science was taking a was in Von Braun's mind to have a big role in the plans, in planning. Well, probably the most helpful man to Von Braun in all of headquarters. The guy that most cooperated.
I got
it. But anyway, he yelled out. And there was his party, and there was Von Braun still, we never sat down. We were still standing at the table.
Right.
Well, of course, it was kind of dark, but I don't know that most of the people there knew Von Braun anyway, but everybody looked around. And Von Braun said, my God.
Just what he didn't want to happen.
So he sat down in the booth. Noggle and his crowd got up and came over to visit with us. We parted around a while, and then we had a few drinks, and it was getting pretty late. And Frank Williams and the others all decided, meanwhile, Noggle's crowd had left. Said, hey, we got to go home. I said, let's go. But I said, well, I'd kind of like to stay a while, I'm not ready yet. He said, Jim, stay with me. Okay. So everybody left, except me and Von Braun, and the place was in only about half full, but the gals were still dancing on the dance, and the piano bar was playing, and the background music. So he says, come on, Jim, let's go by the bar. So we went over and found a couple of stools
right over
the bar.
Yeah.
Right under the women. Now, I'm going to softness in a few minutes. But anyway, what about I'm not sure about drinking right here.
What he might get in his pants.
But anyway, we sat there, and the girls flirted with him, you know, and he didn't do much, didn't make much response.
Right.
He'd comment to me a little bit long. But at any rate, what I was going to tell you, this wasn't all the night. That went on for a while, and I'm not sure yet how this happened, but Bun Brown ended up playing the piano. It wasn't what you call a piano bar. The piano was for the dancing women.
Sure.
Playing the piano while those gals danced.
You are. Is that right?
He wasn't drunk. You know he was a pianist.
Yes, I knew that. And I think he
don't remember what he played.
Proficient with the violin, but
Maybe
earlier, before the... Yeah.
But I still don't remember what he played, because I was still sitting at the bar while he played over there. People even gathered around, you know. But he was playing some jazzy stuff for the girls to dance to.
And do you think anybody else knew who he was?
We never heard.
Okay.
And by that time of night, I think these were just the bar hanger-on. But here's what did happen. So we finally, they were just about ready to close up the bar about 2:30, you know. So he was just having a pleasant time. He wasn't looking for a woman.
Sure.
He would, I don't know whether it's personal morality or whether he's loyalty to Maria or whether he was concerned about his reputation or what.
Sure.
But never once while I was with him did he ever indicate any relationship with a female of any kind or desire to go to to have a female, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw that.
Right.
I saw we had remarks. He made remarks, and he admired the women, and he admired it. He'd make comments. I mean, not ugly, but admiring comments. But he certainly admired women.
Mm-hmm.
But he never wanted. There was no prurient interest ever in the
game. I got you.
But anyway, we came out of that bar. The street was, you know, more or less. One or two people wandering up and down, you know. And as we came out of the bar, here again came this voice, "Hey, Werner Bun Brown." And it was Bob Young. I don't know if you ever remember Bob Young, who preceded General O'Connor as the first director of industrial operations when they created that at Marshall Space Flight Center.
Okay, no, I don't think I...
And they formed all of the engine offices under it, and they formed all of the Saturn V office and Lee James and the Saturn II office, I think, and all, you know, they created the industrial operations.
Sure.
And that was where all of the program offices were put for the various stages and the, you know, and that sort of thing, and the various vehicles and the engine. And Lee Ballou had the engines office, you know, the development office.
Oh, yes, right.
Okay. Well, Bob Young was the first director. He came from industry. I don't remember now if it was Lockheed or General Dynamics out there on the coast. But he came here and served for a while until they brought in Colonel O'Connor, later General O'Connor. And by the way, when they formed that, I was working with Ray Klein up in Von Braun's control office in the programs division or whatever. And I went out to form the same kind of office for Bob Young, and later for General O'Connor in I.O. So I moved out there. They gave me an office out there. Are we over to overstate?
No, I don't think so.
But at any rate,
Bob Young
was wandering along there. I don't know if he was drunk or dope or what. You know, he died a few years later.
Okay.
But he was wandering along by himself. O'Connor had come in here.
Huh.
He had left from Huntsville before Von Braun came to Washington, you know.
Right.
So it was a year or so later. But there again, somebody yelled, so had to stop talking. And Bob Young wanted to know if he wanted to go and let's go and have a drink. Bun Brown had already had enough. He said, right. He said, I know where some women are, or something like that. I don't remember his words.
Right.
He wanted one for it and wanted a woman, you know. And Bob said, in fact, Werner was for the first time, so it was kind of really a little squirmy trying to get out of there. I don't know why. I don't think he didn't like Bob Young. It's this time not to, let's get uninvolved. We've been involved enough tonight. So I drove him back to the hotel.
That is some...
But he just wanted a night out and entertaining, really kind of night out with the boys kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
And he just hair let down completely, you know.
That's
great.
That
was Bernard von Braun, a human being again.
Mm-hmm. That's
all right,
great
one more story.
All right.
I'll quit yapping. On that same trip. In fact, it's a day or two after that. See, we went out from JPL, because that's where we were in Pasadena. We went out to Edwards Air Force Base, which is where the preliminary work was being done on the shuttle. You know, they'd already done the drop tests, you know, with these preliminary models of the shuttle. You remember?
Okay. Oh, yes, models. I do. Right.
And in the meantime, they had built a beautiful, one of the first simulators I'd ever run into. I mean, a completely electronically implemented and computerized simulators.
Mm-hmm.
So, Von Braun, the first thing you want to do is apply the simulator.
Is that right?
He was building it, and he just went in. It was the cockpit of a shuttle. And it was, the simulator was set up with all electronic counterbalances and everything to function just like a shuttle was going to function. And Von Braun wanted to fly. It was so built that a couple of people could stand behind the cockpit seat, you know. So we went in there, we rode the shuttle with Von Braun, and he crashed 3 times coming up the landing.
Oh, darn.
He said, this is going to be a problem.
And this would have been about 70...
That was in 1970. That would be about, they were in March, April, long in there.
11 years before it flew. When did it fly in 80 or 81?
I forgot now.
81, I think, was the first flight.
But this is preliminary.
And
not only that, they had a electronically counterbalanced Gulfstream.
Oh,
set up to fly with shuttle characteristics. See? So the next day he said, hey, I want to, you know, I'm going to go to that. He said, hey, we're going up, I'm going to fly the shuttle. I said, Dr. Von Braun, no disrespect, but I believe I'll stay down. simulator 3 times. So I didn't go up with him. But he went up, and he flew that counterbalanced Gulfstream.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, like the, and I don't know, I don't recall now if he shot landings in it or if he just flew it in the air, you know. But I guess it really had to more or less shoot landings, because that was about all a shuttle could do, you know.
Sure.
With no engine.
Not much power to take off there, right.
All I remember is that Gulfstream weighed about twice what an ordinary Gulfstream weighed with all the instrumentation and everything, you know. But he flew. He was one of the early fires of the simulator on the ground, and then the simulated shuttle.
How be darn.
And he actually did fly. But he did. He crashed 3 times. I don't know how many times he succeeded. I don't recall that. And it was like really crashing, too, in that shuttle, you know, because right before, you know, of course, it was the screen, you know,
sure.
The visuals, because it was realistic. But he didn't crash the Gulfstream.
That is something.
The only other story I tell you is the day that I left for Syracuse. They had a little party for me in the administrator's office there, but before that, Von Braun called me in and sat down, and he brought me to tears, you know, because he was so grateful for the help I'd given him. Not that I'd been such a great thing for him, but he, for about 20 or 30 minutes, you know, he talked to me about things, and then he talked a little bit about what he hoped to do in the future, so he can, you know, get this.
That's when he was leaving.
I was leaving.
Oh, when you were old.
To go to Syracuse. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I've been with him 6 months.
Right.
And telling me how much he appreciated, you know, and all and everything. And he gave me a picture, which I treasure, that said,
sure.
It's got an inscription on it. It says, you know, to Jim Daniels, with regards to something, who helped me to find my way through the Washington jungle.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always appreciated that.
Right.
But he really brought me to tears, you know. He was sincere. He wasn't just flattering me. We talked about several other things, but that was the main thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was pleased that of my interest in the educational area. But Mr. Webb had originally got me interested in that.
Sure.
And that's why I established this relationship with universities while I was there.
Right.
We had a university affairs office, and I'd spent a lot of time with them, and I knew them all, and that way I got to know a lot of the people in the universities around the country involved with the university.
Right.
But Mr. Webb's idea was that there need to be more understanding between the university problems and troubles and situations and university administration, as he said, and management,
mm-hmm.
and the way that government administration and management operated. And I was, my part of my assignment was that bridge, to learn more and to take a little bit of information, a little bit of knowledge about how government operations, management operations work.
I got you.
In fact, I worked with the people in the Maxwell School and in their School of Business and Management.
Mm-hmm.
That was my primary role there.
I got you.
And I did, believe it or not, with the, they had the same problem Von Braun had. Dr. Corbelly, who was leaving, he left when I left the next year. He became the chancellor of the University of Illinois, the total system, University
mm-hmm.
of Illinois system. From Syracuse, he was the chancellor there. And he asked me to do a paper, which I did, on planning. And I brought it, and he had a big planning retreat out at a lodge in the Mountain Lake, you know, and we spent a week out there with all the major players in the university, his vice chancellors and all the heads of departments,
mm-hmm.
on how to set up a planning operation that's so totally chaotic in the university anyway. Again, if you ever talked about a loose coalition of baronies, that was the prime example of the university.
Right.
But at any rate, I still have a copy of that paper. You might want to see it. So it's not brilliant. They're just recommendations on setting. And at the end of the year when I was there, they still hadn't been able to set up a plan and operation. Nobody would support it. It
right.
had no real force, you see.
Uh-huh.
They didn't want it for the same reasons NASA didn't want it. And I could see that.
How
the
bizarre.
Same kind of thing. Infringement on authority and on
bureaucratic thinking. And let me ask you, and we both need
I'm
to
sorry.
Move on here.
No,
it's most interesting. About Von Braun's death, now I know he died of cancer. Was that stomach cancer, do you recall?
Know,
or
I had lost, of course, I was back here. But
right.
yes, that's what I was told.
Okay.
I don't have.
I think that was too. And I've gotten.
He did not know he had cancer when I left to go to Syracuse.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that he had it.
Right.
In fact, I don't think he knew it when he went to Fairchild. But after he went to Fairchild, that's when it occurred.
Right.
And yes, I was told that it was.
And do you have any stories or any accounts that would relate to his dying or his terminal illness there?
No, I can't recall any of those. I really can't. I didn't have close association with people, so I don't know about that.
Right.
Let me give you a summation without being specific words. As I told you, you know, we had many conversations about various things, in particular related, some of them. We didn't sit down and have a religion, a conversation about religion, but it would come up or something.
Sure.
For example, in writing a speech sometimes, you'd be touching on an area.
Mm-hmm.
And my summation was that in the same belief that in the universal creation, creator, was that his beliefs were very much as mine are, that all life is unified. A part of the great creation. All life, therefore, is a part of God or the Creator.
Mm-hmm.
And that I never heard him say the word soul or anything like that, but if whatever survives is that you continue, something continues as a part of creation,
mm-hmm.
whether it be the molecules that dissipate and become part of the air, part of the earth where you're buried, and you know, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a chemical process or something like that, or
right.
chemical. Or whether it be a soul or something. I never had him heard him identify that, but I think he meant some of all of it, whatever it is.
I'm
summing
right. I understand.
Many allusions and discussions over
mm-hmm.
a 6-month period.
Mm-hmm.
When we'd have, and usually it came about when we were preparing a speech or an article for somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that, but
right. not that he believed in the golden gates and
that's right, and an anthropomorphic God, of course.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think he thought creation was one and all, you know. And,
sure.
And that's how he came to this evolving creation. That whatever it is, it's a continuing thing, and it's, in other words, that's his eternity and forever.
Mm-hmm.
Let me make a speculation. I'd say that in his mind, whatever people who speculate at the end of the universe, you know, and all of that is, that nothing ends, you know. If the whole thing collapses and blows up again, it won't end, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't, that doesn't bring in, of course, the fact there's going to be little human beings running around again.
Sure.
And he did believe in the possibility of life throughout the universe. He definitely believed that. He was a great Stuhlinger advocate in those areas, you know, that
I need to run
mathematically alone.